differently than you. When you're investing, do you place your money where you think it's likeliest to make money, or do you invest where you think it will do the most good for the world? Where the world needs the most propping. Foreigners aren't propping up anything in America. Mercantilists think foreigners prop till they drop. Those who think correctly know they invest where they think best. They invest here because they think they will get a better return for their money than other alternatives. If they didn't think this was the case, they would invest elsewhere. No other rational explanation. Finally, myth number 3. A weak dollar is bad for stocks. If you're holding foreign securities during a time when the dollar falls, your foreign securities may seem to net a higher return. The reverse is true as well. Stocks domiciled in a country with a relatively weaker currency may seem to perform not as well at exchange time. Don't forget, to invest globally, you needn't trade your dollars for euros, yen, or ringgit. Buying foreign ordinaries, stocks in foreign countries in the local currency, can be an ordeal for individual investors. You may have to establish a custodian account in that country. Skip the hassle. If you're an American, trade in American Depositary Receipts, ADRs. Foreign stocks traded in gringo dollars. Plus, over the long run, because currencies are so cyclical, the currency effect nets out to be close to zero anyway. But what can the dollar tell us about where the stock market is going? It can make some sense that a strong U.S. dollar might help U.S. stocks, and vice versa. We can check to see if the facts support this theory. If the dollar is weak, then stock returns would similarly be weak. But stock returns can be strong, very strong, even as the dollar is weakening. And that is something true in the U.S. and around the globe. Currencies don't dictate the direction of the stock market, or vice versa. There is no basis for thinking a strong dollar leads to good stock returns, or vice versa. The dollar isn't predictive of U.S. stock performance, global stock performance, Polish stock performance, none of them. Weak or strong by itself, you shouldn't fret currencies. Let's bring in question 3 and think about the dollar the way we thought about the U.S. trade deficit and our stock market versus the rest of the world. When the global stock market explodes upward, you know the U.S. market probably will too, right? They're positively correlated. If the global stock market implodes, you know the U.S. probably will be down too. Sometimes America goes up more than the world, and other times it falls more, but they tend to go the same direction when there is any material direction. And the U.S. is about half the world's stock market, give or take, depending on when you measure. So, if the falling dollar is supposedly bad for U.S. stocks, shouldn't the rising non-dollar currencies be good for non-U.S. stocks? Yes, because they are an equal offset. But there can't be a global falling currency, only global inflation. Likewise, there can't be a global trade deficit. Yet, people act as if the negative is more powerful than the positive, though they never explicitly state this. Yuck, mercantilists! Although, despite their never saying this, there is some behavioralist basis for it, in the concept of myopic loss aversion. Said another way, the U.S., as I update in 2011, is about 23% of global GDP, making the rest of the world 77%. If a falling dollar is bad for the U.S. economy, shouldn't a rising non-dollar be good for the other 77% and more than offset the deteriorating U.S. economy with improvements to the non-U.S. economy? Alas, no one thinks globally much, so they can't quite get themselves to see it this way. These mercantilists aren't stuck in the 1960s. They're stuck in the 1690s. Yes, supply and demand determine currency prices too. Different currencies are simply flavors of money identified by their issuers, central banks, and their banking systems. Because they're commodities traded on free and open markets, they derive their relative value in the same way as other assets, by supply and demand. An exchange rate reflects the value of one currency quoted in another currency's terms. It's entirely relative and has no absolute meaning otherwise. Each particular exchange rate is driven by a complex combination of the supply and demand characteristics of each of the two currencies. Relative increases in demand or decreases in supply will drive one currency's exchange rate up versus another, and vice versa. Currency supply. The base supply of a currency is determined solely by the issuing central bank, expedited by banks operating under it. It has a monopoly on the creation or destruction of its currency. Central banks desire relatively stable prices with moderate monetary growth, which in turn should yield relatively low inflation rates. If they act responsibly, major currencies should have fairly stable exchange rates in the long run, though volatility is normal over shorter periods. However, an irresponsible central bank or a government taking control of its country's central bank can undermine its country's position as a major developed country. Like in Germany's Weimar years. That was arguably a singular example in modern history, as they completely wiped out the German currency in the early 1920s due to excessive money creation, leading to hyperinflation. Developing countries, like Brazil in the early 1990s, often don't have independent central banks and can experience much longer directional currency moves, almost always on the weakening side. But big countries have reasonably disciplined and independent central banks, like our Fed, and typically don't experience permanent, unidirectional currency moves. Over the long run, just like with stocks, supply determines relative currency strength or weakness. When a central bank allows excessive money creation relative to real economic requirements, the excess supply depresses the currency price and boosts inflation. More money for the same amount of assets decreases the currency's store of value. The reverse is true if the central bank is too restrictive in creating money, but too strong a currency isn't a goal either. There's absolutely nothing investors can do about the monopolistic central banking system, besides hoping it won't make too many mistakes. Nor is there any way to predict the long-term direction of supply. Fortunately, our central bankers have gotten better in recent years. The Fed was an unmitigated disaster between 1929 and 1932, as it shrank the quantity of money by 30% at the worst possible time, making the Great Depression vastly worse than necessary and arguably causing it. That was its low point, to be sure. Since then, the Fed hasn't always been great, but, on average, it has been getting better. Traditionally, former Fed chairmen were derided for their many mistakes at mismanaging the economy. William McChesney Martin Jr., Arthur Burns, G. William Miller, they were all criticized widely and wildly after their time. Before he became chairman, Burns criticized Martin nearly endlessly. Martin ran the Fed from 1951 to 1970, giving Burns plenty of time to attack him. Burns claimed Martin knew better than to make the mistakes he did. Martin later claimed when you became head of the Fed, you took a little pill making you forget everything you ever knew, and the effect lasted just as long as you were head of the Fed. After becoming head of the Fed and coming under attack himself, Burns claimed he took Martin's little pill. To people under 50, this was a play on a famous health aid called Carter's Little Liver Pill, which had nothing to do with being good for your liver. Its name was changed to Carter's Little Pill and is, in fact, a laxative. They were all criticized, and rightly so, as they all made many mistakes, but fewer as the decades went on, and they learned from prior mistakes. Paul Volcker was the first Fed head not roundly criticized later, although Volcker forced the 1980 and 1982 recessions in the name of breaking inflation's back. Some would say that was too heavy-handed, but overall, he did a better job than any prior Fed head. Greenspan was next and did better still, because he was capable and could learn further and more. Their predecessors were assuredly not idiots, though Miller might have been politically, but he is another story altogether. They were just doing the best they could, stabbing in the dark based on largely untested theory with, by today's standards, very primitive data collection capabilities and vastly inferior electronic analytical capability. Only with the onset of improved technology and 24/7 instant information could Fed heads test theories and check for correlations. That is, do question ones, before deploying policy to horrific results. And they could react faster and learn from prior mistakes. As a result, we've seen fewer egregious policy errors in recent decades. Errors still happen, like when Greenspan created way too much money in 1999 in fear of potential Y2K problems flaming the economy. Then he sucked it back out in 2000 after Y2K proved unproblematic, helping make the 1999 and 2000 boom-bust bigger than otherwise. But mistakes are made less routinely and massively than in the pre-Volcker era. Greenspan's worst mistakes were pretty good compared to the best of earlier decades. The same has been going on overseas. My guess is, as central bankers benefit from future improved information flows and accumulated lessons of the past, on average, they keep making mistakes, but the mistakes are fewer and not as bad. As major developed nations, central bankers tend to make fewer dumb errors. Intermediate-term currency volatility may decline somewhat from historical levels. Currency demand. Demand for currency is determined by several factors. Principal among them is the amount of economic activity conducted in that currency. For example, a grocery store in Dallas uses dollars, not yen. The more economic activity using a particular currency, the more demand for that currency. Another important money demand source is the store of value. If investors believe assets denominated in a currency will hold or grow in value versus other assets in different currencies, demand for that currency grows. Short-term, from minutes to months, factors impacting demand include when a senior government or central bank official jawbones, speaks favorably or unfavorably about a currency or interest rate, which can push short-term sentiment and shift demand, but usually only fleetingly, moving currency markets for a few minutes up to perhaps a month. Also, discretionary central bank open market operations, when a central bank buys one currency in exchange for another, can have a short-term impact. But no one bank has a big enough balance sheet to overwhelm all the other factors impacting the currency market by simply exchanging currency. Even frequently demonized speculators can have some small and fleeting impact on demand and the relative prices of currencies. But speculators have an even smaller impact than central banks because their balance sheets are so much smaller. Decades ago, George Soros did take down the Bank of England, down hard, but only because in that earlier era it had put itself in a position to be taken down, and Soros is widely quoted as saying the same could never happen these days. Further dissipating the impact of speculators is the fact they generally don't act in any organized fashion. Speculators speculate on different currencies going in different directions, and to some extent, they cancel each other's impact. Like stock movements, currency movements are exceedingly fickle in the very short term. You shouldn't care much about what a currency does from day to day, or even month to month anyway, unless you're betting on currencies, which has all the same qualities of betting on any other commodity. What really drives currency demand? Time for another question, too. What can you see driving currencies and demand for them others can't? There are a few obvious factors contributing to short-term shifts in supply and demand for currencies. First, non-discretionary central bank operations. When a country pegs its currency to another currency, the Chinese yuan and the US dollar, for example, the pegging central bank must either buy or sell the other currency to maintain the relationship. Second, When one country's economy grows faster than another, the demand for its currency increases because more transactions take place in that currency. Both of these are easy to fathom. You don't need question two for them. But what else could drive currencies? What can you fathom? Each and every day, speculators make bets on exchange rates through what is called a carry trade. A carry trade works thusly. You borrow short-term money in one currency, convert it to another currency, and buy a short-term bond, though you might choose to make a longer-term bet with a longer-term bond, in the new currency. The idea is to borrow at a lower interest rate and buy a bond yielding a higher rate on the presumption the higher yielding rate won't fall enough to reverse the interest rate spread during the period you hold the bond. Done right, the difference between the two rates is free money. Everyone likes free money. The key is to borrow in a currency you think won't appreciate markedly against the higher interest rate currency where you will park the money. A great question, too. Since you're selling the borrowed currency and buying the currency you lend into, if many people do this all at once, it tends to make the acquired currency appreciate. Then you get not only the interest rate spread, but also the appreciation on the currency, icing on the cake, very attractive. It would be completely irrational to borrow at a higher interest rate and buy a bond with a lower interest rate. That is the reverse of free money. So, if country A's short-term rate is lower than country B's, investors are more likely to borrow at country A's lower rate and invest at country B's higher rate, putting downward selling pressure on A's currency and upward buying pressure on B's currency. Currency prices then become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy as carry trades take place in huge volumes daily. In theory, it makes sense. But let's scope some actual scenarios to see if this is correct. Consider the yield curves for the US, the UK, Japan, and the Eurozone at the beginning of 2004. At the short end of the curve, the US curve is well below the UK's and the Eurozone's, yet still above Japan's. It so happens the dollar was weak that entire year. Investors were borrowing in America and investing in short-term instruments abroad, contributing further to a weak relative dollar. If you borrowed in America at a 1% 6-month rate and lent into Euroland at above a 2% rate, you picked up the 1% spread as free and easy money as long as the euro didn't fall in value. Since lots of people did it at once, they sold dollars and bought euros, pushing the dollar down and the euro up. The opportunity was even more extreme if you lent in Britain, which is the reason the pound sterling was so strong. In 2005, after multiple Fed fund rate raises, the short end of the U.S. yield curve had risen above Germany's and Japan's and was closing a lot of the gap with the United Kingdom. The dollar strengthened considerably during 2005 against pretty much every major world currency, as the carry trades started going in the other direction. Effectively, as the Fed raised short rates, it choked off the carry trades that had been holding the dollar down. With some exceptions within developed Western nations, countries with the higher short-term interest rates that kept moving higher tend to have the stronger currencies. Countries with low short-term interest rates that remain unexpectedly low tend to have weaker currencies. This pattern is compelling and makes sound economic sense due to carry trade activity. Another way to say that is, demand for a currency increases, and the price with it, when appropriately moving yield curve differentials between countries, pay people to be more eager to own a given currency. This is why the British pound sterling for a long time was so strong relative to the US dollar and many other currencies. Britain kept its interest rates higher than everyone else's. Pretty simple. As the Fed paid up in 2005, people stopped borrowing in U.S. dollars, selling and investing overseas, and instead started doing the reverse, borrowing overseas and buying dollars. Then the dollar strengthened. Demand for currency, more than not, increases when central banks pay people to demand more of their currency, which relates to them adjusting their supply. What I'm telling you isn't unknown, but few notice it, and fewer still believe it, which is why it will have legs for some years. You can use this information to discount strong currency sentiment based on myths we debunked earlier in this chapter, and you can use it for a rational basis for a market bet. Investors talk about supply and demand and know intuitively supply and demand drives prices, but just aren't applying these concepts to the securities, bonds, and commodities they buy. And if they do, they typically aren't thinking about supply or demand correctly. Now that you know securities pricing is always and everywhere a result of supply and demand, you can focus your energy on what counts and start to make more reliable 12-month forecasts. And that is something you can know that others don't. But how can you make a forecast? And how can you know what the market is more likely to do? For that, we move to Chapter 8. Chapter 8. The Great Humiliator and Your Stone Age Brain. That predictable market. Presume at every turn, the market is actually out to get you. I'm not being paranoid, it's true. I don't call the market the Great Humiliator, TGH, for nothing. Think of it as a dangerous, predatory, living, instinctual beast doing anything and everything to abjectly humiliate you out of every last penny possible. Just knowing and accepting that is the first step to getting the whip hand of TGH. Your goal is to engage TGH without ending up too humiliated. In the next chapter, we talk about how to create a strategy to increase the odds you reach your long-term goals. But first, let's talk about exactly how to use the questions to see clearly how the market operates so you can cease being humiliated. TGH head fakes you by moving in disorderly patterns. We know the market historically has averaged about 10% yearly over long time periods, so is it reasonable to expect about 10% absolute returns each and every year? No way! Since 1926, there have been relatively few years the stock market has actually returned something close to the long-term average. Normal market years are anything but average. Not only are returns wildly variable, but it's a global truth. Think globally and check elsewhere. In the UK, TGH goes by Ye Olde Humiliator, YOH. In Germany, TGH is Der Große Demütiger. Returns should continue to be wildly variable year to year. From this disorder, your brain doesn't neatly notice the market doing one of only four things in any given year. These four market scenarios are: 1. The market can be up a lot. 2. The market can be up a little. 3. The market can be down a little. 4. The market can be down a lot. Markets can do myriad things in short spurts in a seemingly disordered way, but it really does just one of the four things in the course of a year. These four conditions simply simplify possible outcomes and help you see more clearly and make more disciplined decisions. They also provide a way for you to assert self-control over your behavior. Note, I said behavior, not skill. And are the essence of asking yourself question 3. Your brain, working with TGH, tries to persuade you the market will do any number of things. But all you must focus on is whether you think it likeliest the market will end up a lot, up a little, down a little, or down a lot, looking out about a year. Everything in between is TGH distracting you. Four things. Is it nudging up or down a little? Is it a meltdown or a melt up? Investors almost never think about a melt up, but it's as important as a meltdown. Direction, not magnitude. Focusing on these four market conditions helps you make the key decisions having the most impact on your portfolio. The asset allocation decisions. The four conditions are a framework for guiding your behavior and keeping your brain from leading you astray. Also, what's most important about your forecast is getting market direction right, not magnitude. Why? Because getting the market direction right keeps you on the right side of the market more often than not. Also, if you expect up a lot, up a little, or yes, even down a little, you want to be maximally exposed to equities as dictated by your benchmark. It doesn't matter if you think the market will return 8% or 88%. Either way, if your goal is longer-term growth, your major asset allocation decision should be maximal equities. Your sector weights might be impacted by an up-a-lot versus an up-a-little forecast. But even if you get all of that wrong and still make the decision to stay fully invested in equities and are right, you should enjoy the return you get from getting the asset allocation right. This is all about getting the horse before the cart, and not vice versa. You may rebel at remaining maximally exposed to stocks in expectation of a down a little year. Should you try to avoid down a little downside by shifting to cash? In my view, only if you're supremely confident and not overconfident, you know things others don't. Otherwise, you're too likely wrong for what is only a little benefit. Trying to avoid a down a little year is the perfect example of a brain overcome by overconfidence. Even if you expect down a little, my view is you should focus on relative return. Beating the market is beating the market, even if your absolute return is negative. If you think the market will be down a little and want to move heavily away from stocks, ask question 3. First, you may be suffering from myopic loss aversion, and you should try accumulating some regret. Second, recall you may be wrong, and the market might be up a little or a lot instead. The difference between up 5% and down 5% in a year can be just a psychological wiggle toward year-end based on serendipity. But even if you're right and the market is down a little, the transaction fees you incur selling your stocks or funds, ensuing tax bills on your gains, and inherent timing errors outing and inning can seriously reduce any benefit you might gain by skipping a down a little move. Then ask, if you get out, will you know when to get back in? Will you time it right? Probably not, and certainly not perfectly. If you're really looking for market-like returns, and if you're listening to this book, my guess is you are. Remember, the long-term market average includes negative years. In the course of your long investing time horizon, you will experience periodic downside. You should expect it. Downside is intensely painful to live through, but is part of the reality of the long slog that is investing in equities with an aim of getting market-like returns. Renew your faith in capitalism, grit your teeth, and know better times are ahead. Also, many presume they'd prefer a portfolio that's up when the market is down. But a portfolio like that likely lags when the market is up. If the market is positive more often than negative, which it is, and you have a portfolio running counter to the market or cutting off the downside at the expense of upside, you won't average out to be happy. Recall always, when you go to cash, you adopt massive benchmark risk. You become completely unlike your benchmark. And just think what happens if you're really, really wrong and there is a melt up. You incurred transaction costs, paid taxes, and lost maybe 25% relatively or more, which comes to about 1% a year over the next 25 years. Very hard to make up. This is exactly what people do at the bottom of major bear markets when they choose to remain out, so they can wait for things to become clearer. In exchange for avoiding a down a little possibility, they forsake an up a lot market. In my mind, for long-term investors wanting market-like return, there's no error more damaging. Look out below! As for the fourth scenario, the down-a-lot scenario, it's the only time, in my view, it's appropriate to take on massive benchmark risk by moving heavily away from equities, going to cash, or another defensive posture. Then, and only then, should you focus more on absolute return instead of relative return and try to beat the market by a lot. But if you're right, you get relative return too. If you are very confident the likeliest outcome is the market being down huge, 20% or more, maybe 35%, 40%, or even 50%, then it can make sense to try for cash or bond-like returns. Getting a cash-like return doesn't sound like much, but if you are correct and the market is down a lot, you have blown the market away on a relative basis. This should be rare and prompted only by something you are supremely confident you know that most others don't. It shouldn't be done by gut feel, by fear, or by your neighbor's opinion. The three questions should figure in largely here, and the benefits can be huge. If for 30 years you simply invested in a passive index fund, but just once in those years you sidestepped a 25% drop while getting a 5% cash and bond return, over the 30 years you would do 1% per year better than the market. In the process, you would have beaten more than 90% of all professional investors based on only one correct bet. Getting defensive successfully even just once or a couple of times, even if you don't do it perfectly, can provide you with a major and lasting performance boost. At a bull market peak, there is endless advice saying you should never turn bearish and you should never time the market, and that people who do are destined to miss the big returns of bull markets. In 2000, this advice was rampant. This is simply TGH sucking you into the bear market as it moves disorderly down a path few will fathom. Make no mistake, the rewards from occasionally seeing a bear market correctly are big enough to justify building your bear market muscle, knowing you use it exceptionally rarely. After bear markets, the heroes are those who did time the market and turn bearish. Many of them will have been bearish way too early, often for years before the bull market peak, having been a perma-bear. Stopped clocks who often have miserable long-term relative returns but are short-term media heroes nonetheless. Alternately villainizing then making heroes of those who went defensive is TGH at its finest, as it teases investors' brains to keep looking backward instead of forward. The key is to keep the bear market timing skill for long periods of time when it's never used. Dry powder for the rare day you need it. I've turned defensive only three times, mid-1987, mid-1990, and late 2000. I was very lucky each time. The next time, I'll probably screw it up. Reminding myself of that is one way of reducing overconfidence. Avoiding a big slice of those bear markets is a huge piece of what built my career. When you avoid a slice of a full-fledged bear market, you simply buy years of excess return. If you went into the bull market peak slightly lagging the market, one successful bypass of a chunk of a bear market catches you up and moves you ahead. It's hard keeping a skill set you use only a few times in your investing life honed and available. Most folks won't, which is why you should. They want to hone the skills they use daily, not once a decade. Getting it wrong. I wrote The Next Time I'll Probably Screw It Up, late in 2006. This book was originally published in 2007, and as it turned out, I did not correctly foresee the 2008 bear market. Am I disappointed? Yes. Am I surprised? No. As I wrote here, seeing bear markets correctly is very tough. Making the decision to get defensive and move heavily away from equities is also tough. The toughest and possibly riskiest move a money manager can make from a relative return standpoint. In my 2010 book, Debunkery, I write more on why, for long-term growth-oriented investors, Being fully exposed to a bear market feels bad but shouldn't derail you from achieving long-term objectives. This is hard for most investors to get, but if you want long-term growth, that is just going to come with market-like volatility and periods of being down. Even down huge. Knowing that can help you avoid making knee-jerk decisions in response to downside volatility that can have much longer-term repercussions. Building a defensive portfolio. Suppose you use your three questions and are confident the most likely market scenario over the next year or so is down a lot, a true bear market. What do you do? What should a defensive portfolio look like? It depends. You may hate hearing that, I know, but it's true. Different bear markets are different. In some bear markets, some sectors survive swimmingly, but you won't know which until it is on you, and maybe not even then. In sustained bear markets, if you forecast them well, a mostly cash portfolio can make the most sense. Liquidity is key. Markets move fast as bull markets begin, so you need to be prepared to get back in. If you're illiquid, or you ease your way back into the market, you're likely to miss the big bang of the bottom. You can use money markets and short-term government bills. You probably don't want to buy anything with a long maturity unless it can be sold instantly. Be defensive, but liquid. Market neutral. As an example, during the 2000 to 2002 bear market, I wanted a portfolio that acted cash-like but with better than cash returns. I wanted to be immunized against downside volatility and to be very liquid so I could quickly get back into the market. I wanted tax efficiency, and I wanted to take advantage of knowing something others didn't by overweighting certain sectors and underweighting others. Since I expected tech to be weak and had dedicated significant resources to that call, I wanted to get some juice from it. To do that, I had to be market neutral. Own equities with sector exposure, but no net exposure to owning equities. What does that mean? I created what I called a synthetic cash portfolio, encompassing all those goals. My asset allocation during that time added up to 130% of my real portfolio. Here's how. First, I had 30% in huge blue-chip, defensive European and U.S. stocks. Big drugs, banks, and consumer staples. Anything that was considered defensive, so cyclicals were out. I wanted companies with inelastic demand for their products, not elastic, since during bear markets, folks tend to dial back their discretionary spending. A lot of these were super cap stocks bought in the late 1990s with capital gains I didn't have to realize because I didn't have to sell them. Effectively, you can think of it this way. When the time comes to create synthetic cash, sell what you can that doesn't involve a capital gain, and then do the index shorting, mentioned shortly, to ensure you don't lose capital from the bear market decline. Next, I had about 38% in liquid U.S. government bonds. Not too risky. I had 2% in index puts against the S&P 500. I bought puts expiring about a year out. Index puts are a classic dream. They're relatively cheap insurance with relatively low premiums at the right time, market tops, and very expensive insurance at the wrong times, market bottoms. Index puts are just like casualty insurance, where the casualty is the index dropping big. The puts would pay off handsomely if that happened, and simply expire worthless if it didn't. I had little to lose with such a small position. A 2% loss, if they didn't pay off, would largely be covered by my bond income. But the portfolio would get considerable juice if the bet paid off. Every time the stocks sagged, the puts soared in value. Then, with 30%, I sold short the NASDAQ 100 and the Russell 2000, 20% and 10% respectively. Took the proceeds and held it in cash. Another 30%. 30% plus 38%. plus 2% plus 30% plus 30% equals 130%. That's how I had 130%. My bet was the combination of the Nasdaq and Russell would drop more than the stocks I held, so I borrowed the indexes and sold them short with the hope, when they dropped, I could buy them back at a lower price, and the difference was all profit, and bigger than the losses I had on my stocks that fell. Instead of reinvesting the proceeds from shorting the indexes, I held the cash in the event I was wrong, but even the cash earned some income. This time I wasn't wrong, and the market fell a lot during those bear market years. This portfolio fared very well in those conditions. The Nasdaq 100 short did a lot better than the Russell 2000, but together they worked just fine, rising in value as the stocks I held fell. I don't know how I'll construct my next bear market portfolio, but next time, based on the conditions then, I'll likely try to create contemporary synthetic cash that is non-volatile, liquid, tax-efficient, and still allows for some stock and sector picking. Anatomy of a bubble. As mentioned previously, I did fine forecasting the three bear markets in 1987, 1990, and 2000, and missed the one in 2008. I'll address 2008 in a bit, but what led me to forecast the tech sector-led bear market in March 2000 were worrisome realities I felt others were missing. Seeing something dreadful others miss is the basis of a successful bear hunt. Pros were too bearish, expecting negative or single-digit returns in 1996, 1997, 1998, and 1999, as U.S. stocks exceeded 20% each and every year. The consensus finally turned strongly bullish in 2000, as measured by my sentiment-based bell curves, which you recall were still little utilized then and therefore still had considerable power, agreeing the market would break the 10% mark. I knew I could rule out anything under the consensus bell from flat to up 20%. I was left with the possibility of an up-a-lot year and two holes on the bearish side, either down a little or a lot. I wouldn't turn bearish just to be a contrarian, but I was concerned about an inverting yield curve because no one talked about it. As you know, inverted yield curves are fairly reliable predictors of bear markets and recessions, if few notice them. And it was happening globally. But no one was talking about it, so there was no fear of it. By contrast, in 1998, the financial press couldn't stop clamoring about an inverted U.S. yield curve, even when the yield curve didn't get past flat. But in 2000, no. They talked about it in 2005, probably because no one talked about it as it happened in 2000, and, of course, in 2005, there was no recession or bear market. Bond yields were also very high compared to earnings yields. There had been a lot of equity-based takeovers. The only really bullish feature was it was the fourth year of the president's term. And there certainly wasn't fear, period. Business Week's January 2000 cover story lauded the new economy. The premise was not only sky-high tech valuations were here to stay, but they'd soon be mimicked in other industries and globally. But Business Week wasn't the only one. I could find little bearish sentiment, except the cadre of perma-bears. Just a year earlier, Y2K was supposed to be the end of all life as we knew it. 2 years earlier, the Russian ruble crisis and the bankruptcy of a second-tier hedge fund were widely feared capable of crippling the world. Having made it through all that, folks opted for optimism. Based on sentiment alone, it was responsible to contemplate the benefit of a defensive posture. But that is a long step from actually turning bearish. There was something fundamentally worse that no one saw. After years of tech IPOs, stock supply was, in my view, threatening to drown demand. The late 1990s tech boom was measurably almost identical structurally to the 1980 supply-demand imbalance in energy stocks. I wrote about it in my March 6, 2000 Forbes column entitled 1980 Revisited. That the article was published mere days before the tech and U.S. market top was pure luck. I had no idea this particular market call would be so timely. Bubble trouble. It's always a new paradigm. I'm hesitant to use the word bubble since it's bandied about so much by so many who understand bubbles so little. Bubbles are much more often forecasted than they ever truly appear. And when a true bubble is inflating, it's often overlooked. Before they burst, real bubbles are often seen as a new paradigm, a new era, fundamentally different from the past, where the old rules no longer apply, where you get great returns with little or no risk because it's different this time. Read more in my 2011 book, Markets Never Forget, about the danger of believing it's different this time. Before Japan's bubble started bursting in 1990, it was seen as having superior businessmen with whom the West couldn't compete. When tech was a bubble, it was the new economy. But when something is called a bubble that hasn't actually burst yet, it means the price has gone up a lot, and a lot of people fear it will go back down. This is our heights framework again. That fear is often already in the market, minimizing risk by its mere presence. When something is really a bubble, it's not usually called a bubble, and people don't fear it. In the years 1997, 1998, and 1999, there was no national press coverage of tech as a bubble. Tony Perkins wrote a book late in 1999 describing internet stocks as a bubble, but it got little notice. My Forbes column calling tech a bubble was one of the first appearances of that word in national print associated with tech. And what I saw in early 2000 was eerily similar to what I had witnessed and later measured without having actually forecasted it in the energy sector in 1980. A real bubble with the potential to start a rippling, fierce, sector-led bear market. Think back to 1980 and how unstoppable the energy sector seemed. Thanks to 1970s global central bank monetary mismanagement, inflation was soaring and commodities booming. OPEC was powerful while the Iran-Iraq war was raging. Oil was $33 a barrel, and the consensus was forecasting $100 a barrel in 4 years. No one was calling for oil prices to fall. Just so, in early 2000, the consensus foresaw internet users tripling globally in 4 years, and most folks were heralding the new economy, saying things like, earnings don't matter, it's a new paradigm, it's clicks, not bricks. There were abundant energy-to-tech parallels. In March 2000, the 30 largest U.S. companies represented 49% of the U.S. stock market's value, and half of those were tech stocks. Rewind to 1980, and the 30 largest U.S. stocks made up a third of the U.S. market's value, and half of those were energy. The relative valuation multiples compared to the whole market for energy in 1980 were similar to those for tech in 2000. Too many parallels, all unnoticed, seemingly by anyone. So I could fathom an outcome not dissimilar to 1980s. Another key overlooked parallel was the number of IPOs as a percent of all stocks. Swelling supply. The energy bubble also featured an IPO boom, then a stock price bust. I started with the notion a flood of tech stock supply might topple prices. In 1980, nearly half of the increase in value of all new and existing U.S. companies came from the energy sector. In 1999, nearly all of the increase came from the technology sector. Also, there were many similarities between the percentages of new tech stocks relative to all new stocks and all U.S. stocks in 1999 to those of 1980's energy bubble. And the price-to-book value of each sector was trading at roughly twice the market multiple. Who would remember today that, in 1980, energy stocks were priced like growth stocks? Scary times. The key is, few saw or mentioned it. At its 1980 peak, energy was 28% of the U.S. market. But tech's explosion was more remarkable, growing from 5% in 1992 to just over 30% in 1999. The way I saw it, tech had further to fall, but it didn't need to fall much further to create the same major bear market energy created between 1980 and the summer of 1982. Both of these observations weighed heavily in my decision to call a peak in the tech market in 2000. In some ways, I could fathom tech being worse than the energy bubble. In 1980, none of the 50 largest energy stocks were an IPO of just a few years before, say 1978 or 1979. The 1978 to 1980 IPOs, though many, were smaller. In 2000, 11 of the 50 largest stocks were IPOs in 1998 and 1999. That increased risk, in my view. Was I certain tech would implode and the market drop? No, but it was logical. First, all the ugly parallels to 1980 seemed invisible to everyone. Second, you had to wonder who was left to buy who hadn't done so. Who was left as fresh fodder for TGH? Based on sentiment, the yield curve, the budget surpluses, equity-based takeovers and energy parallels, I was content to eliminate possibilities of an up-a-lot or up-a-little scenario for 2000. Then again, down-a-lot seemed unlikely too, as I knew from looking at 1981, it took a long time for the oil meltdown to ripple out through other sectors. A sector bubble bursting doesn't normally ripple to other sectors fast, so my presumption was tech would start down and be down a lot. But it would take time to drag down the rest of the market. So for a major market meltdown, we would be waiting longer. Finally, I knew bull markets die with a whimper, not with a bang. Bull markets don't normally have a dramatic spiking top, but roll over slowly. Around the 2000 peak, there was over a 10-month period where the world stock market never got out of a 9% bandwidth. Note again, tech started 2000 as 30% of the total S&P 500. If a 30% sector is down 39%, as NASDAQ was in 2000, and everything else is flat, then the whole market should be down by 11.7%. But the S&P was down only 9% in 2000. So technically, the rest of the market, the non-tech part, was up a hair. The sector breakdown hadn't rippled out to take down the rest of the market with it. But throughout 2000, my view was the tech sector continued deteriorating. I could see new tech companies burning feverishly through their cash, just as new energy companies had in 1980, almost identical proportions. We could measure how many would run out of cash if they didn't get back to the public market to raise more money, implying either company implosion or yet more new stock supply. Either had to be bad, looking forward. For a gauge, we calculated the burn rate for as many new tech stocks as we could find data. Burn rate measures how fast a firm will run out of cash in the absence of new cash. To measure burn rate, we compared cash and net losses through the second quarter of 2000, it being September when we last did this. Assuming these firms found no further outside funding, we divided current cash by second quarter net loss to get the burn rate. In all, we found 223 material publicly traded companies so short on cash, if they didn't pull off a new stock offering very fast, they would be a quaint memory. In just one quarter, the aggregate market cap of companies fitting this mold jumped from $140 billion to over $312 billion. Not from the prices rising, but because so many were increasingly close to hitting the wall. And no one was counting. The market was flooding the stock with stock supply from profitless companies. With the IPO market soured, pretty much all these companies were gone 12 months later. The bubble had only just begun to burst. Putting together this information is pretty straightforward should you ever want to measure burn rates yourself. All the information we detailed is publicly available. You just need a fast internet hookup and a sector you suspect. Most unsettling was no one noticed the parallels between the tech fervor and the last sector bubble 20 years earlier. I wasn't the only financial practitioner to have witnessed the energy crash, by any means. I wasn't the world's only person with access to the data for comparison. There were lots of folks who should have seen this before me, but I couldn't see them seeing it anywhere, which was scary. Around the campfire, they were peering a different direction. Nothing had yet changed to alleviate the cash-starved supply flood of tech IPOs and secondaries. In my view, as 2000 ended, supply had finally likely drowned demand. Dot-com after dot-com ran out of cash. This had to ripple out of being a sector-specific phenomenon. The rest of the global market would start pricing in the supply glut. If there had been even a little fear in the market about tech, or the yield curve, or anything, I could have seen the market being down just a little again in 2001. When most everyone has no fear is the best time to get really fearful. The wonderful mantra attributed to Mr. Buffett is, "You should be greedy when others are fearful, and fearful when others are greedy." I could fathom at the end of 2000 there simply being no buying pressure in 2001 to keep the market from being down a lot. As 2000 faded, with the NASDAQ down 39%, the S&P 500 down 9% for the year, and investors and professional forecasters still bullish, I finally concluded the time was nigh to turn fully bearish, not just bearish to tech, but overall bearish. Sympathy selling. Often, though not always, in a bear market, some sector goes bad first. Selling ripples to other sectors in a process I call sympathy selling. It works like this. Suppose you were a generic tech mutual fund. You own little dot-coms and big established tech giants. Out of nowhere, as some of your dot-com holdings implode, you get simultaneous redemptions. You must sell something to get the cash to cover redemptions. What do you sell? You can't sell the little dot-coms getting hammered so badly. They aren't that liquid, and you hope they'll bounce back. So you sell your Intel, Microsoft, and Oracle, because you can. Big and liquid stocks. And that selling hits those stocks. But this is also happening to all the other generic tech funds. But then some growth stock funds own tech, drug stocks, consumer products companies, and whatever else. As Intel, Microsoft, and Oracle get hit, that fund manager must sell something else to cover his redemptions, so he reaches out and sells Merck and Procter & Gamble. This ripples from fund to fund, having the most impact where the process started, but eventually rippling far enough to hit not all, but most of the market. From 2000 to 2003, the only parts of the market that escaped were the small, steep discount value stocks, exactly the reverse of where the damage began with high-end growth tech stocks. And by the way, this sympathy selling was evident in 2008 into 2009 as the damage done in the finance sector rippled out to other sectors. So in 2000, I cut my tech holdings, and at the end of the year, I got completely defensive and stayed that way for 18 months. Some basic bear rules. Why 18 months, you ask? While bull market durations vary considerably, most bear markets last about a year to 18 months on the outside. Very few in modern history last fully 2 years or longer. If you're making a defensive move, you probably shouldn't bet on one lasting so long. The longer a bear market runs, the more likely you're waiting too long to get back in. The 2000 to 2002 bear market was unusual, longer in duration than the 2008 bear market. The 2008 bear market was huge in terms of magnitude, though the 2000 to 2002 one had big magnitude too. That we had two big bear markets in a row likely make many think bear markets are normally that long or steep. An example of recency bias, and a cognitive error. If you are betting the next bear market lasts much more than 18 months, you are basing that bet on a historical outlier, and you must have strong fundamental reasons, not based on fear or emotions, backing up that view. Then, too, if you remain bearish for longer than that, you may miss out on the rocket-like ride that is almost always the beginning of the next bull run. Missing that can be very costly. Further, if you get out successfully and time proves your success, your Stone Age brain may fear exposing you to losses, which could keep you out until after that initial next bull market rocket ride. Staying may feel more comfortable. It lets you feel right longer, particularly if you convince yourself the start of the rocket ride isn't real. Your brain wants to accumulate pride for having gotten out successfully. Switching back to bullish means you might be wrong, and if you are, people will ridicule you, and our antiquated brains hate that. Bear markets rarely last as long as your brain wants to think they do once you've gotten out successfully. You hear plenty of rhetoric about cyclical bulls within long-term secular bears, which is supposed to mean positive years are blips in an overall downward supercycle. But history is decidedly clear here. Stocks rise much more than fall, and true secular bear markets just don't exist. Not the way many think. Read more on the fallacy of hunting for secular bear markets in Markets Never Forget. Understanding the nature of bear markets makes it clear why it's good to define, in advance, a re-entry time frame. Historically, only about a third of bear market losses occur in the first two-thirds of the bear market duration, or what I call my two-thirds, one-third rule. Mind you, none of these rules are binding and all should be accompanied by other fundamental reasons for making any broad asset allocation changes. It's a gross generalization, but about two-thirds of the losses don't happen until the back of the bear. The 1973 to 1974 bear market was a good example. You won't time your re-entry perfectly. I sure didn't in 2002. Expect that now. The back of bear markets being brutal is TGH's way of humiliating you out of the initial rocket surge of a new bull market. The flip side of this rule is, the start of bear markets isn't steep. It's later they get steep. For the first 10% to 20% of the duration after the peak, the market slips slowly. This isn't true for all countries. Small countries can have very steep drops off the peak. But for America, the total foreign market and the world as a whole, it's very true. So, when looking for a major bear market, you needn't try to forecast it before it peaks, which is near impossible to do. It's easier to see a peak after something has happened than beforehand, when nothing has actually happened. At market bottoms, the reverse is almost always true. While bull market tops don't spike top, bear market bottoms do V-bottom, or sometimes W-bottom. Think about the bottom like a V or a W if there's a double bottom. If you successfully get defensive sometime after the peak, does it matter which side of the V you get back in on? Not really. You still end up in about the same place, no matter whether you got in on the left side of the V or the right, adjusted for a little interest lost from getting in too early. TGH wants you to wallow in loss aversion and hindsight bias, waiting to get back in until the market has rallied materially. Exiting at the right time takes guts, if you can forecast the bear correctly, which is devilishly tough. Getting back in is equally agonizing. The 18-month rule can help provide discipline and self-control. If you want to exceed the 18-month rule, fine, but create your own limit beforehand, whether 20 or 22 months, or whatever, and stick to it. One way to combine my rule with yours is to take the 18 months and see where you are. If, after 18 months, you believe you still know something others don't as to why the market should keep going lower, let it go lower. If it isn't lower a month later, force yourself back in. If it is lower, let it keep falling, but if it gets back up to where it was after 18 months, then force yourself back in. That would be one way to force some discipline. You're just on the same place on the other side of the V. Take your unruly brain out of the picture. Here's another reason you needn't time the start of a bear perfectly. Every U.S. and global bear market we've looked at, except two, had an average monthly decline, top to bottom, ranging between 1.25% and 3%. But 2% is a fair enough average. 1973 to 1974 is a good example again. The exceptions are 1987, which was so short-lived in duration, and 2008. That bear market, the biggest since the Great Depression, had steeper average monthly losses thanks to a precipitous drop in roughly the final third after Lehman Brothers collapsed, making it another exception. The purpose of this particular rule is to prevent yourself from bailing on what may be normal volatility. If you suspect you are experiencing a bear, be patient and watch. If you see a market decline exceeding the 2% average, wait for it to bounce back before getting out. You may simply be experiencing a correction. But with a typical bear market, you'll soon see a short-lived pullback to higher prices within that 2% per month range off the top and have a better chance to get out. Patience is a virtue here. Joe Goodman was a wise man and longtime running Forbes columnist. I surpassed him to become the fourth longest running columnist in August 2007. To my thinking, he was the best columnist Forbes ever had. He advised readers in the 1940s and 1950s to never call a peak too soon. He advocated waiting 3 months after you suspect a peak has happened before calling a bear. Again, none of these are hard and fast rules to be blindly adhered to. Rather, they are meant to help instill some discipline and keep you from pulling the ripcord too soon on a correction and then watching a bull market soaring still higher. And if you see any of these rules or a combination of them, in my view, you still must see something fundamentally and hugely bad few others see to justify getting defensive. Never a dull moment. If you are a long-term growth-oriented investor and take one thing away from this book, it should be that you shouldn't take forecasting a bear market lightly. The world is a scary place, but that has always been true. That big, scary events happen, and happen a lot, isn't sufficient to cause a bear market. As investors, we misremember past events and our reactions to them, hindsight bias. So we think we handled them better than we did. But history is rife with major events, and stocks have overall risen with volatility through it all. It may surprise you how resilient stocks have been. Look at a list of historic events and try to remember, honestly, what you felt during, say, the Cuban Missile Crisis, if you were around, or when JFK was shot, or when the American embassy in Iran was seized, or Y2K's approach. Don't let hysteria scare you heavily out of stocks at what may be an inappropriate time. That is just what TGH wants. When bulls cross-dress. TGH will try fooling you into thinking every bull market is really a bear market in disguise. TGH conspires so a new bull market comes dressed in all the trappings of a secular bear market. Bull markets are unabashed cross-dressers. I've never seen a bull market that didn't come to the party wearing a full-on bear suit. Unfortunately, most investors aren't looking for cross-dressers. All they know is, way late into the party, whammo! They've missed out on the first 50% up leg of a bull market because TGH had their minds warped. Arm yourself against TGH by knowing how to tell a cross-dresser from the real deal, a correction from a bear market. The major differences are magnitude and duration. A correction is a short-term, 10% to 20% scary global downturn. But sometimes can be a bit more. It's typically short, sharp, and comes from nowhere with a spike top and a fantastic story leading you to believe more downside is ahead. It's usually over just as fast and rockets higher, returning to new heights about as fast as it fell. But while stocks are falling, it can feel like it's going on forever. You may think 20%, just like mid-1998, is quite a lot and officially qualifies for a bear market. But the operative words here are short and sharp. Right off the cliff, defying our 2% rule. Corrections are common in bull markets, one every year or two on average, and devilishly tough to time. You shouldn't try because they down and up so fast. To time these successfully, you must be right on both ends. Odds are you'll miss either a good exit or re-entry point, or both. Don't bother. No one, and I mean no one, in the history of asset management, with all the tens of thousands of practitioners, has ever made a successful long-term practice of timing short-term downturns. If it were possible, at least one person would have done it by now. But no one has. And if you could, you wouldn't be listening to this book. Similar to a down-a-little scenario, any benefit you get by being super lucky and accurately timing a correction can get eaten up by transaction costs and taxes. When bears cross-dress. But a bear market's beginning feels nothing like a correction. It feels fine. Usually. A bull market top won't announce itself with a sudden price drop. There is no announcement effect. Except 1987, the exception to the rule. Even 2008 wasn't like that. Instead of a bull in a bear suit, you get a bear in a bull suit. As stated earlier, bull markets have grinding, rolling, whimpering tops, and a relative absence of bearish sentiment, other than perma-bears. You won't hear a bang. You likely won't feel like you are about to experience a prolonged downturn. In fact, you might feel like your diversified portfolio is boring and you should place big bets on individual stocks or spectacular sectors to boost returns. Historically, if markets have been positive 72% of the time and some of those negative years were only down a little, you're looking at very few years of the truly scary, bearish, down-a-lot type. They happen. They hurt. But if you want long-term equity-like returns or thereabouts, you likely are exposed to that downside. And when it happens, it can be easy to believe stocks will only ever do lousy going forward. But history, fundamentals, and the power of profit motive, and human nature, all argue against that. Another way to see this is if you're bearish much more than 3 or 4 times in 2 decades, you're likely overdoing it. Recall, as human beings, we normally exert more effort to avoid pain than achieve gain. Remember that. If your brain keeps telling you a bear is always impending, your brain is wrong. Successful bearishness requires being virtually alone. You must act alone, without others. But if you have the 3 questions, you're never really alone. Getting in too early. Making a successful bear market call is only half the battle. If you get defensive on the stock market, you still must decide when to get back in. Our Stone Age brains make deciding when to re-equitize as fraught with peril as deciding to get out. Just as you can't rely on a fixed set of indicators to get out, there's no magical way to know when to get back in. After my tech bubble and bear market call, my firm and I decided to get bullish again in May 2002. In hindsight, too early, because broad markets didn't bottom until October 2002. I didn't expect to time the bottom perfectly, but getting in the market just in time for TGH to throw a precipitous drop at you is never fun. Why did my firm and I decide to get back in the market that May? Following are key reasons. And despite being wrong and too early, these were rational, disciplined decisions driven by the three questions. According to my 18-month rule, I was committed to re-equitizing by June 2002. I was not comfortable with missing equity exposure for longer than that period for clients expecting equity-like return. The consensus was bearish for the first time since the bear market started. Therefore, I thought down a lot was the least likely condition over the next 12 months. As it turns out, 12 months later, the global market was down, but basically down a little. It remains impossible, in my view, to ever know with certainty where the market is moving in the next few months. This time, even though I was right the market wouldn't be down a lot a year out, it was down a lot almost immediately. I stepped into a hole. No one likes negative returns, but I wanted to remain equitized in the expectation of the first three scenarios. Bear market investment products were proliferating, such as mutual funds specifically designed to do well in down markets. Bear market newsletters were then wildly popular and their writers considered rational sages. Major sources of bad news were widely known and, in my view, discounted into pricing, their surprise power having largely dissipated over the previous 2.5 years, including recession, earnings deterioration, and potential bankruptcies, terrorist attacks and the impending war, accounting scandals, Enron, WorldCom, and the rest. At the time, it looked as though a double bottom had formed between September 2001, just following the terror attacks in New York, Washington, D.C., and the skies over Pennsylvania, and May 2002 lows. Monetary conditions were generally favorable. Broad money growth was greater than the inflation rate. Short-term liquidity was on the rise, and we had a steep U.S. and global yield curve. Most important, few noticed. For the first time, foreign markets were acting stronger than America's, signaling a potential shift and possible end to the global bear, although this would fade away again until returning with a vengeance in 2003. A piece of capital markets technology we developed, the Run Strength Indicator, showed the market was vastly oversold and ready to move up. Unfortunately, all the data we had built it on were from post-World War II, smaller global bear markets, and on its first real-time maiden voyage, it didn't adequately reflect reality. The Run Strength Indicator. The Run Strength Indicator was a measure of sentiment fatigue. It's another example of capital markets technology my firm developed using Question 2, and a way to measure short-term sentiment that is a major driver of stock demand, and a big part of determining stock prices in the short term. It was a complicated algorithm combining many factors that basically offered hope of knowing when a market move, up or down, was simply too fatigued to continue. Giving it an indexed number of 0 to 100, we had observed when a variety of different equity indexes all fell below 20. A strong rally followed. Conversely, when it rose above 80, an extreme overbought condition existed, and prices usually fell. We back-tested this, and it stood up well. In May 2002, the indicator fell to extreme lows, far below 20, seemingly signaling an extremely oversold condition. We witnessed this on most major indexes. This condition hadn't been seen in decades and might not be seen again for decades. To not use it when we did would mean we probably wouldn't anytime soon either. But it had never been used real time before. While we back-tested it extensively, we hadn't been able to test it in relevant real-time conditions. But time was of the essence. By late June, we knew the indicator clearly hadn't been working right as a timing mechanism. In hindsight, we can see sentiment can and did get very much worse. Effectively, the Run Strength Indicator simply wasn't up to measuring something as extreme as that bear market, reflecting instead more normal bear markets. Still, all the other rules applied, so we had no reason to turn and get back out. I accumulated regret and learned some good lessons. A small way to get back at TGH. Creating capital markets technology for infrequent extreme phenomena requires using old, historic data that are comparable. But will those data be clean? I already knew, but better learned through this process, that old data are pretty consistently corrupt in ways hard to know. This experience really put through my forehead the need to be sure the old data are good. As a result, we have yet more stringent and exacting ways to confirm old data to make sure we're basing assumptions off as close to reality as we can get. The more extreme and infrequent, the more you must be sure. Clean data are next to godly data, and also next to impossible. Here's another important lesson I learned. I learned to listen more to my clients, but in a different way from what you might think. When we got reinvested in May 2002, we noticed virtually none of our clients thought that a bad idea. They were eerily complacent about the decision to take their assets from entirely cash and synthetic cash to fully exposed stocks. When we got out of tech, that was widely seen as a missed opportunity, and of course, in retrospect, it wasn't. But very often, investors want to do exactly the wrong thing at precisely the wrong time. But in May 2002, we thought then our client base wasn't representative of the rest of the world. Since we had avoided most of the downside in the bear market, we subsequently thought they had heavy confidence in us and therefore didn't fear stocks. We found out within a month that couldn't have been true as the market fell. Many clients let us know they didn't enjoy that. As a result, we have built redundant technology aimed at measuring the same thing in our client base, real-time, moving forward. Our client base is big enough to be representative of American high-net-worth investors as a whole, and hence, a great laboratory for testing sentiment. If our clients don't feel the fear, it's probably not broadly out there. Today, we can measure daily incoming call volume of clients and calibrate it, and aggregate the degree to which our client base is feeling fear or extreme optimism, which is on its own a valuable sentiment tool. Of course, I missed other things. I didn't see the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation coming at us in July 2002, which was and remains a negative. I underestimated the degree to which society would temporarily adopt the all CEOs are crooks mentality late in 2002, that both led to Sarbanes-Oxley and seemingly was also partly fueled by it. For example, by July, rumors were rampant in and out of the media, Jack Welch was a bad guy, and GE would be the next Enron. If GE could go bad, then everything could go bad. All that was just sentiment, but I didn't see it coming. But seeing the sentiment twists of the last stages of a bull or bear market is both difficult and often done wrong. And this time, I was simply too early and wrong. Getting in too early was a big mistake to make, but as long as you're right more than wrong, even if you are really wrong from time to time, you can still beat the market in the long term, which is what the game really is about. When I was back in, I was still moving with the market. Not getting out. As I update this book, I have yet another wrong call that has given me the opportunity to keep learning. As I've said throughout this book, investing isn't a craft. It's a non-stop query session, but also an endless learning session. I missed the 2008 call because, in many ways, that bear market had many features inconsistent with most past bear markets. Its top was utterly devoid of euphoric or even optimistic sentiment, unusual for the bear markets I'd seen or measured before. To me, the early stages were classically characteristic of a correction, and indeed, in my view, it might have been nothing more than a correction. Had it not been for the deleterious impact of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, Rule 157, Fair Value Accounting. In short, this rule caused banks to value illiquid or near illiquid assets using standards that simply didn't make sense. It forced banks into a near self-perpetuating cycle of asset write-downs that basically obliterated their balance sheets, forcing them to sell other assets to comply with fairly arbitrary capital ratios. This forced a number of even large institutions to the brink, which didn't help investor sentiment at all. Further, the bear market started in late 2007, about when the rule went into practice, and ended in March 2009, when it became clear the rule would likely be suspended or killed, and it has in fact since been killed. My view is that's no coincidence. Then, too, the government's response to financial firm weakness in 2008 was incredibly haphazard. Some firms were pushed into arranged marriages, like J.P. Morgan and Bear Stearns. Some nationalized, like AIG and Fannie and Freddie. And some were simply left to die. Lehman. There was seemingly no rhyme or reason to how each situation was addressed, and markets don't like uncertainty. My view is, without FAS 157, and then the haphazard government response, 2008 would have been a big correction or even a smallish bear market. Then again, I might be wrong about that, and there'd be no way to know. My point is, if you aim to get long-term equity-like growth, you always face the risk of getting walloped hard by TGH. All you can do is learn what you can and keep investing by looking forward, not back. A key lesson from the 2008 bear market was even small accounting or regulatory rule changes can have an outsized impact. So we built into my firm the muscle to review changes and analyze what future impact they may have. It was a hard lesson to learn, but investing is a non-stop query session. Some lessons will be easier, some harder. For those interested in reading more on the 2008 credit crisis and how it evolved, I highly recommend Senseless Panic by William Isaac, former chairman of the FDIC. The 70-30 Rule. I've been wrong quite a bit in my career. I'll be wrong again. I know it and expect it. That's all part of investing. And yet, CXO Advisory Group, an independent website ranking market prognosticators, has consistently ranked me among the most accurate long-term public forecasters anywhere, based on my Forbes columns starting in 2000. My Forbes columns are a good but not perfect proxy for the market strategies my firm deploys for our clients. How can it rank me so highly? As I've said thus far, in investing, your aim shouldn't be perfection. That's impossible. Your aim should be to increase the odds you're right more than wrong. As I write in 2011, CXO gives me an accuracy percentage of 63%. You can find its guru grades, its terminology not mine, at www.cxoadvisory.com. It doesn't have anyone right now at 70%. Just being right 51% is enough to give you an edge over the market. 70% makes you an all-time legend, but that still means super legends must be comfortable being wrong 30% of the time. If I could simply sign a contract to be right in the market 70% of the time and wrong 30%, I'd sign the contract. Put down my money and never bet beyond that again. You might still get some market bets pretty astoundingly wrong, but over time, being right more than wrong wins out over pretty much everything. What causes a bear market? There's simply no single answer to the question. What causes a bear market? It might be monetary conditions, yield curve shifts, surpluses, a sector implosion, excess demand reverting, or bad legislation impacting property rights. But it likely won't be what it was last time. Two bear markets in a row rarely start with the same causes because most investors are always fighting the last war and are prepared for what took them down last time. Maybe you suspect a bear market will start because the bull market has run on too long. Question 1. Is there a right time a bull market needs to last? No. There is no right length for a bull market. As bull markets run longer than average in duration, there is normally a steady stream of folks who say a bull market must end because it's too old. Read more on this phenomenon in Markets Never Forget. That isn't right. They all end for their own reasons and will end eventually, but age isn't among them. People started saying the 1990s bull market was too old in 1994, only about 6 years too soon. Irrational exuberance was first uttered in 1996, again, way too early. Bull markets can die at any age. Use your questions to test some of these. Find a few of your favorite indicators and see if they've reliably led to bear markets before. You will find there is no fundamental indicator on its own, no technical indicator on its own, no single silver bullet, no nothing on its own perfectly predicting when a bear market will start. Nor can you have a feeling indicating when you should get out. I hear from far too many investors, even professionals, they have a funny feeling about the market going one direction or the other. They can't explain, but they just know. That's TGH. If it isn't, take an aspirin and an antacid and get over it. Then, take question 3 for this one, because that's what you really need. If you believe you've been right about a funny feeling in the past, you may have been. Luck happens. But you're also suffering hindsight bias and forgetting times you had funny feelings that were completely wrong. Osama bin Laden, Katrina, and Foghorn Leghorn walk into a bar. Some may say, but we live in a different world now. A terrorist attack would break the market, right? That's a fair question. The tragic attacks on September 11, 2001 came two-thirds of the way through a material pre-existing bear market and a recession, possibly stalling off market resurgence, though we have no way to measure if that's true or not. So pull a question 1. Is it true September 11th had a lasting, devastating impact on the market? The U.S. stock market closed that day and stayed closed until September 17th, when trading resumed. The S&P 500 nosedived when the market opened, down 11.6% by September 21st. But amazingly, in only 19 days, the U.S. market was trading above September 10th levels, and it remained above those levels for months. We remember this differently because long before the attack, the global economy was in a recession and bear market. Did the attack exacerbate the situation? Maybe. But again, the market retreaded the steep fall and stayed above pre-9/11 levels for months. Note the higher period included all those fears in the fall of 2001 about anthrax. Remember anthrax? The market moved higher right through it without interruption, lifting to prices steadily higher than on September 10th. As always, think globally to see how more recent terrorist attacks on Western nations have impacted the stock market. On March 10, 2004, Al-Qaeda took credit for a massive train bombing in Madrid. The Spanish referred to the event as our 9/11, a devastating national tragedy. And yet, the S&P 500 dropped 1.5% that day and traded at pre-attack levels 5 trading sessions later. On July 7, 2005, Al-Qaeda bombed the London Underground, and the S&P 500 was positive that day. The market was indifferent to the attack. Terror attacks have since continued, and markets largely shrug them off, continuing whatever trend they were on anyway. Whether all future attacks have already been discounted or not is debatable. But since 9/11, there has been no market panic to terror anywhere. How can investors be so blasé about terrorism? This is a new, terrible, and very real threat to us wherever we live, work, travel, and defend ourselves and our friends. Or is it? We have had previous terror attacks here in the U.S. and on U.S. interests. There was the USS Cole bombing in 2000, and the Khobar Towers were bombed in 1996. and that first attack on the Twin Towers in 1993, and the attack on the Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1983, and Pan Am Flight 103, and the entire history of Israel, and the Irish Republican Army and Britain. The British lived with terrorism on their soil seemingly forever, and their markets did fine then. World War I was sparked by a terrorist act. There were the Barbary Pirates and Tripoli. You get what I'm saying. Terrorism isn't new, devastating as it is at a human level. But we are resilient, and so are our markets. But would a larger terror attack now break the market? First, ask if another terrorist attack would surprise you. You may be more surprised, knock on wood, we've yet to experience another major American attack. As of this writing, still in 2011. Put yourself back to September 10, 2001. No one fathomed 19 thugs armed only with box cutters would perpetrate a coordinated attack using planes and their passengers as bombs. That what happened would happen seemed unthinkable. Today, it would take a lot to have a major market-moving surprise, and even the biggest terror attack in recent history had limited direct market impact. What if they destroyed a major American city? What if terrorists destroyed a major American city? Certainly that would be terrible. But how big would the market impact be? Again, it might be less than you might think. And the way you know is partly by looking at the market impact of Hurricane Katrina on New Orleans. In 2005, New Orleans and parts of the Gulf Coast were obliterated by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Much of the Gulf of Mexico's oil refining capability came to a screeching halt. Hundreds of thousands in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi were homeless or displaced. Businesses closed. Employees were jobless. And yet, the day Katrina hit Louisiana, August 29, 2005, the market rose 0.6%. A pretty normal day given the flooding and ensuing chaos, and GDP growth for Q4 2005 was 2.1%, and the S&P 500 was up 2.1%. Not blow your socks off growth, but not the economic Armageddon many pundits predicted. Think about it this way. U.S. stocks were up 2.1% in Q4 2005, and global stocks were up 3.1%. So the U.S. market, even post-Katrina, was not too far off from the world. Of course, maybe stocks would have risen more without Katrina. But who can prove that? Yet, shouldn't GDP have been hurt hugely based on work stoppage and disruption of refining in the Gulf? New Orleans was decimated. That is a great question, too, to explore. Let's flip this one on its head. Why shouldn't GDP and stock returns be healthy following such a major natural disaster? Scale it, like always. Suppose every person in Louisiana was suddenly unemployed after the two storms. Didn't happen, but suppose the worst-case scenario. There are 4.5 million Louisianans. Louisiana's income per capita is historically only about three-fourths as high as America's average. So think about the population of Louisiana instead as about 1% of the United States population. If every single person in the state of Louisiana stopped contributing to GDP as a result of the hurricanes, GDP growth would have been shaved by about 1% one time. For 1 year, instead of maybe 4% growth, we would have gotten 3%, then moved on normally. I don't mean to say Louisianans aren't productive people and important, but you shouldn't be surprised there was little impact on the overall economy's growth. America is huge. Louisiana is too small to impact America's GDP much. Then, remember, it's a global market and global economy, and America is only 23% of global GDP, so the impact on global growth would be smaller still. Simple scaling. Remember Grandpa Fisher? We also have history to use conveniently. The first thing I did when Katrina struck was pull out my stock charts and history books to remind myself of the natural disaster that devastated my hometown. When the 1906 fire and earthquake leveled San Francisco on April 18, 1906, little was left. Grandpa Fisher, see Chapter 5, had to put off his wedding to my grandmother until later that year. They and their families lived with most of the rest of the city in tent camps in Golden Gate Park. My grandfather's medical practice was on hold for months as he devoted himself to pro bono work for those injured by the tragedy. But the market didn't buckle. The U.S. market dropped a hair in April, which might have happened anyway, and might have been caused by other things, I don't really know, but was higher again in May and June and didn't implode that year. The major buckle was the next year, 1907, with a New York-based banking panic and the market dropping 49%, peak to trough. But San Francisco in 1906 was more important to America than New Orleans in 2005. San Francisco's demise not causing the market to implode in 1906 was a pretty good guideline from history to tell you not to worry about Katrina too much from a stock market perspective, and to tell you not to worry about markets too much if the terrorists, heaven forbid, ever do succeed at causing real havoc in an American city. You can use the questions and this methodology to attack other presumably bearish events, such as outbreaks of SARS, the bird flu, Ebola, hantavirus, anthrax, chickenpox, etc. Just as SARS was a big 2003 health scare, now long forgotten, in 2005 and 2006, concerns about bird flu morphing to a human transmittable form were rampant. And again, markets were fine. Use your questions to test if any geopolitical event, natural disaster, health crisis, anything we all worry about, plan for, fret about, and hear on the news is inherently likely to move the market materially. You will find none of these events is a silver bullet for predicting bear markets. Now that you have question three tools for recognizing the likely direction of the market and can understand what a real bear market does and doesn't generally look like, you are ready to build a real strategy to serve you your entire life. Listen on. Chapter 9. Putting It All Together. Stick with your strategy and stick it to him. As Chapter 3 hinted, one tool to stay disciplined with the three questions and keep your scurrilous brain in check and not be humiliated by TGH is having a comprehensive strategy driving decisions. Just using the three questions is great, but a strategy provides a basis and framework from which you can ask the three questions and make small or big bets, keeping you on the path toward your goals. Maybe you think you already have a pretty good strategy. Fair enough. But many investors who believe they have a strategy may confuse tactics with strategy. For example, some investors want market-like returns with low fees, so they want a strategy of buying no-load mutual funds. That is a philosophy, not a strategy. Operating that way without a strategy, 30 years later, you may not have paid any load fees, but you also may not have gotten decent returns. Another tactic many investors, including many professionals, use, believing it is a strategy, is rigid adherence to a static asset allocation. That is, fixed percentages of stocks, bonds, and cash. Static asset allocation may be a fine self-control mechanism for people who otherwise lack self-control. Just like having someone else prepare all your meals can control your weight if you can't hack it on your own. But static asset allocation ensures you can take advantage of the three questions when opportunity knocks. Investors also use stop losses and dollar cost averaging, both self-control mechanisms and already provably losing strategies. Buy and sell options and covered calls. another losing proposition. Short here, go double long there. All believing they have a strategy that works, not realizing they may just be spinning their wheels with tactics, some fine, some not, but all tactics. A gaggle of fancy but ineffectual tactics do not a strategy make. There's nothing wrong with deploying a particular appropriate tactic, emphasis on appropriate, that is, not stop losses, at a given time. But it's no more a strategy than a hammer is a blueprint for a home. What's more, what's the point of using tactics if you don't know something others don't? You want the hammer only when it's the right tactic to accomplish the strategy. You're far better off using the questions to figure out something others don't know and using that knowledge to get ahead rather than possibly losing your money in a slow trickle through tricky investment tactics without a strategy. A strategy is a plan guiding your every decision. It keeps you disciplined when you're tempted to stray. The market simply isn't intuitive. One reason so many fail at it. Usually, what's right feels wrong, and what feels wrong often is right. This is why you need the questions and a strategy to keep your brain in line. Before you begin thinking about a strategy, let's establish a few ground rules about what you can hope to achieve. Ask anyone what their investing goals are, and you'll find a plethora of answers. Think of your own goals. Can you describe them simply with a sentence or two? If it takes 10 pages with accompanying visuals, you may not have as clear a strategy as you think. No, it should be fairly straightforward and specific to you. For example, have you ever been asked by a financial advisor to rank your level of risk tolerance? Your inquirer may have had you fill out a questionnaire to determine what kind of investor you are. But very often, such check-the-box surveys best reflect how you feel that day. What's more, you may be asked if you fit in certain broad but undefined categories like growth, aggressive growth, growth and income, etc. Maybe you were asked to pick from a selection of colorful pie graphs or rank yourself on a scale of 1 to 7, or 1 to 10, or 1 to 37. The problem I find in this method is, first, what's growth to one person is aggressive to someone else, is conservative to someone else. What's more, feelings investors have can change. The same folks who filled out questionnaires in 1999 saying they were highly risk-tolerant and saw 20% returns year after year were saying they were risk-averse in 2002 and 2003 and merely wanted low, safe, absolute returns. Nothing about their long-term goals and needs may have changed materially, just the way they felt about recent market action. And if they make changes to their long-term strategy based on how they feel about recent market action, they could be making a costly mistake, one that may not materialize until too far down the road to do much about it. Sometimes, as an individual investor, it can be hard to determine if your own self-assessment of risk tolerance is driven by your actual long-term goals, or if it's influenced by what you've read recently, what has happened to you recently, who you're talking to, and what you think they're supposed to say in response to such questions. Then, too, investors' responses may differ depending on whether they're with their spouse and offspring or not. It's a lot easier for a guy to fancy a pirate's lifestyle buccaneering the South Seas for adventure and booty when he's alone watching a pirate movie than when he's with his wife. As Meyer Statman and I demonstrated in a scholarly article titled The Mean Variance Optimization Puzzle, Security Portfolios and Food Portfolios, risk is multifaceted and virtually impossible to fully comprehend in any moment for anyone. Your brain deals with investing risk just like it does with food and diet. Eaters and investors want at least six things at once, in both investing and their next meal. The risk they feel at any time is tied to whichever of those things they're not getting, without regard for how they would feel if they didn't get the things they are getting. It's tough for your brain to put it all together at once. It fixates on what it isn't getting, and to you, that's risk. I won't fully rehash that article here, but investors not only want return, of course, they want to keep up with the Joneses, or not to suffer from excess opportunity cost. This is why the person who envisions he only wants 10% a year actually feels angst when the market is up 35% and he is only up 20%. To him, that's risk. Investors also fear volatility and see it as risk. It is. Finance theory has been excessive in portraying volatility as the risk measure. But it's just one risk and preys more on some than others. Of course, investors want pricing. Different investors want the pricing differently, but they feel risk if it becomes inconsistent with their sense of what it should be. They want packaging. Packaging ripples into all the other risks but includes presentation, ease of use, and part of the sense of confidence implying safety and less risk that is basic to all marketing. They want prestige. Prestige can mean many things, including branding, appealing to that sense of uniqueness. A general sense of safety or lack of risk from perceived quality, and a sense of higher social order than others. Another way to think of this is bragging rights. That is, I got in on Google's IPO and you didn't. But if you take the prestige away suddenly, it feels like risk to them. Then they want order preference. Few appreciate how important order preference is to everyone, but you can see it two ways in diet. One is why people eat breakfast foods in the morning and dinner foods at night. Why not switch them around? Same calories. And yet people largely obey order even when no one is cooking. The second is how people don't experiment with the foods they combine. Why not try putting salad dressing in your coffee and cream on your salad or even your steak to see how it would taste? Might be better. You don't try because it violates order preference. And if you tried that in public at a restaurant, the people with whom you dined wouldn't dine with you again. They would think you were a nut. My point is, at any moment, the risk you notice and fret is associated with what you're not getting, and it's near impossible to make your brain realize all the other things that you are getting, and how you would feel, how you would experience the risk about not getting some combination of them. Growth or income or both. You're a unique, wonderful person, I have no doubt. However, you're probably unique just about like most everyone else. You're not statistically unique. In a statistical sense, being unique is to be way, way out the end of the bell curve on some set of attributes. If you're really unique, you're technically quite weird. Most folks like to think of themselves as unique, but don't like to see themselves as weirdos. As such, if you're a long-term investor, you probably share similar investing goals with a fair-sized chunk of humanity. What's more, when boiled down, investing goals can fit into three basic categories. 1. Maximize terminal value. 2. Cash flow. 3. Some combination of the two. Maximize terminal value. If maximizing terminal value is your goal, you're looking to grow your portfolio to fund retirement, to purchase something now or in the future, a first or second home, a college education, a boat, etc. Or to pass to loved ones or a favorite charity. You might also think of this goal as growth. But maximizing terminal value doesn't necessarily mean increasing your pot of money. You might need to stretch your money enough to satisfy cash flow needs, the next goal. For example, a common response when asking someone what the primary purpose of his or her money is that it's to take care of him or her and the spouse for the remainder of their lives. That may involve growing their total money or simply stretching it, but it's probably the most common single case among investors everywhere. Cash flow. Many investors need their money to provide income to cover living expenses now or in the future. In an extreme example, some folks might be very happy if daddy simply died and left a guaranteed income stream and they had no say in the investments and not necessarily any knowledge of how the assets are invested. Just like Gertrude Stein. Party time! Of course, the party time inheritor isn't really concerned with income, as that term is technically defined by industry wonks. What he or she wants is predictable and secure cash flow. Cash flow is the better way to think about this. Finance theory is clear we should be agnostic about our preferences for type of cash flow on a real, tax, and risk-adjusted basis. For example, it doesn't much matter if our cash flow comes from dividends, which may be risky or not, or capital gains, which may be risky or not. Income streams are neither better nor worse for generating total return than capital gains. We should care about total return after adjusting for tax and risk. Otherwise, how the cash flow comes is unimportant. Terminal value or cash flow or some combination of the two, that's about it. Although there is a very wide variety of subsets falling under these headings, such as, I want to leave as much as I can after I die to the Save the Seals League, which means maximizing terminal value, in this case, for the purpose of charity. Sound fair? For example, an investor who is 50 may see the primary purpose of his money as taking care of him or her and a spouse for the rest of their lives. But they have a secondary purpose of leaving a certain amount to their offspring and more to charity. They want to maximize the likelihood of that being done successfully by maximizing their terminal value at the end of their lives. Doing so allows the cash flow they need to support their lifestyle while leaving a present for the kids, and maybe the seals. That seals it for them. Most long-term investors are somewhere on the scale of needing terminal value, cash flow, or both. What about capital preservation? There is yet a fourth possible goal, true capital preservation. True capital preservation means taking absolutely no risk to preserve the nominal value of your assets. In my experience, capital preservation as a long-term goal is more rare than folks think. It would apply if you know you already have much more money than you'll ever need, and you are confident inflation won't erode your purchasing power. That is, you have no desire for more, and your primary purpose is to minimize your worry or hassle factor. Then it can make sense. But for folks investing for the long haul, my experience tells me that's rarely the case. On a shorter-term basis, capital preservation can make sense. Some folks might be saving for the down payment on a home in 6 months. It makes sense, then, to preserve the cash needed for that home in a low-risk instrument like a CD. For a